Welcome to On Strategy Showcase. I'm Fergus O'Carroll in Chicago. Tons of consolidation going on as part of the streaming wars and the structure of traditional cable and entertainment studios. It's been quite fascinating to watch. Billions have been spent on original content over the years, and it appears to have simply led us back to what we were trying to escape in the first place, which was having to pay for content and bundled channels we had no interest in watching. If I'd fallen asleep 20 years ago and woke up today, it wouldn't appear that much has changed. A terrific article in the New York Times last week about the wasteland that is cable today, the hours of back-to-back reruns and the lack of investment in new programming. If you're interested, Crossstream Media does a great job of serving up bite-sized observations on the shifts in the streaming industry. Their newsletter is State of the Screens. They're not a sponsor of the show. I'm just a huge fan of what they do. Maybe you might want to check them out. While many brands are being decimated during this time, others are being built. And I think an example of that is Tubi. Here's a clip from today's episode.
It just felt like a really clear way for Tubi to turn their biggest weakness, which was perceived as having a shitload of content, but nothing to watch. Like, it was all kind of B-grade for this mainstream audience that we were trying to break into, to actually our biggest strength, where because we have so much content and there are, it is so offbeat, but because of that, you can go on this pathway, this rabbit hole, if you will, of content that feels like it's made almost exclusively for you.
That's Ed Gunn, Executive Strategy Director at Mischief in New York City. He and Tubi CMO Nicole Parlapiano join me to talk about Tubi's strategy. Tubi is a free ad-supported platform owned by Fox Corporation since 2020, with roughly 50,000 movies and TV shows. Nicole has worked with Mischief to shape a clear expression of who Tubi is. They've produced some noteworthy work over the last 18 months, including multiple Super Bowl spots like the famous Rabbit Hole. You can see the creative work on our website at onstrategyshowcase.com. And in the meantime, here is my Tubi interview with Nicole and Ed. Enjoy. Generally, what I do before I start, I start an episode as I rewatch the creative and kind of get sort of refamiliarized with it. And so before this recording, I was actually laughing out loud as I watched all this work here. So that doesn't happen a lot. So when it does, it kind of starts my day off on a really strong note. So welcome to Nicole. Thank you for being here. And thank you for allowing this kind of great work to become real. So kudos to you.
Thank you. Thank you. I mean, I feel like that was a compliment. It's sad that we have to say that. But I am happy to be here. And, you know, I live to give LOLs. So I'm glad that you were having a good laugh.
It was so great. And it's Ed Gunn. Welcome, Ed.
G'day, Fergus. How are you?
I am really good, man. Great to have both of you here. Great to be talking about Tubi. It is, it's for some reason, I'm fascinated by this space of the streaming landscape and what's been happening over the last few years. We've done a show on Amazon, an episode where we talked about this. So I'm excited to just touch on this for a little bit about what your take is, Nicole, on the sort of shifting landscape, and particularly with streaming. There's so much happening, so much is changing, business models are shifting, revenue models are shifting, and everything just seems to be realigning. In some ways, it's going back to the past in terms of how things are being bundled, and then in other ways, of course, it's forging ahead. What's your take on the landscape today in streaming?
I do think there are a bunch of different models. It's super dynamic. It's super exciting. Something is always happening. But for Tubi, we are the number one ad-supported streamer in the market, and in US and Canada at that. So ad-supported is something that I think is like wildly misunderstood and still like is taking some time to educate the market on the business model and how the business model is different. And so I think we've been super successful with that focus as a pure play ad supported model. Whereas you're seeing, you know, a lot of companies are pursuing, three different tiers or different subscription tiers with ads. You know, there's a couple of other players that are fully ad supported, but I think our strategy and the way that we think about the business is almost entirely different than you would if you were a pure play subscription.
So if I look around, I think of Sling, I think of Pluto. I look at my smart television and it wants to be a portal into every content that I now watch. I look at Roku, Amazon Fire TV. I look at Tubi. How do you compete amongst that? Is it's obviously an ad supported network. Do you think about it as competing based upon content offering, based upon a demo you target?
Yeah. I mean, I think what's interesting is we are not hinging our hat on original content. And we are not, that is not our sole focus. And it's really more of a library and a portfolio play. A lot of our business is rev share with, you know, smaller production companies. Because we're fully ad supported, we can, you know, share revenue similar to YouTube. So I think my focus has always been that, and just around the belief that, yeah, there are all of these big mainstream tentpole shows, but even those aren't as big as they used to be. Even, you know, and there's just so much confusion in the market about what shows are even available where. And
exactly, yeah.
It takes me back to this Puck Media article that was released in February that was very validating for our strategy because it said all of these shows, the most popular ones, like 60% of the viewers could not tell you what they watched the show on. So for Ted Lasso, like, 60% of the people thought it was on Netflix, you know, and yeah. Then Apple had to do an ad with Timothée Chalamet reminding everyone these great shows are on Apple. They're not on HBO Max and they're not on Netflix. And so we really, you know, because our content is in our brand, we really kind of strategically decided to lead brand first. And I think that has definitely paid off. Now, do we have to get, I think over time, we'll get a lot sharper now that we've been doing this for a while. And like I said, we have these so much viewer engagement. We can kind of start to understand certain viewer communities better and program for them.
It's a perfect play on brand, Ed. I mean, what's your sort of take before we get into how this relationship started with Mischief? Tell us about your take on the landscape. What do you sort of see out there prior to the relationship with Tubi?
I think the biggest thing that we saw was, and it's echoing Nicole's point, a lot of the brands are kind of playing on the exact same battlefield, like the streaming wars as an example. Like their ammunition and their weaponry is content, and they're spending $25 billion a year on content. I love Netflix and the things they make, like what they create. Same with the artist formerly known as HBO Max, which is now Max. All of these things are great, but I never understood what the brands truly stood for. Like, I didn't know the tone of voice of what Netflix is. I knew what their shows were, similar to Max. I knew what their shows were, similar to Disney. I knew who they were for, the audience, etc. But it didn't seem like there was any distinctiveness between each of the brands in terms of who they were and what they meant for people. So having a look at that, it was like, what could Tubi do? What could their role be within it? And it did feel like there was a huge amount of space to play for someone that had a bit of attitude, a bit of personality, and really stood for something at the individual level. When I look at the landscape of what the streaming wars has created, it's a constant, almost race to the bottom in a weird way, where you're spending more and more money to try and get attention at a single point in time to hope that people forget that they're subscribed to your service and pay you monthly, rather than actually falling in love with those brands. You fall in love with a show and then forget you're actually subscribed to that show.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's a big challenge. All of the money that was invested, it was like it was a gold rush and everybody was trying to get subscribers or get attention. And then I think they sort of created a problem that they were trying to avoid, which was the idea that I chase shows, I don't chase channels. But there is something that's really interesting that's happened in the way that we consume content over the last couple of years. We have sort of rewired our brains in terms of the way that we want to watch content, which is what makes what you guys are doing kind of brilliant. This idea that we're we're binge watching content. We've been sort of retrained to consume content in new ways, which totally plays to your strength, Ed, with Tubi. Was that something that you guys looked into as you were doing some planning?
Yeah. I think it was, like, we needed something to push against. And I think the idea of like just sitting in and talking to people and how they actually view the content, the things that were bubbling to the surface within Tubi, it feels like the category has dictated what an objective measure of quality is. Like, it felt like the most quality show that exists, like Game of Thrones or Succession, anything like that, you kind of need to get the family tree out and figure out how all the pieces go together. You needed to really think in and do this.
It needed a whiteboard.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it is invariably complicated, and that's great, because this idea of being like highbrow and academic is what's worth. You can see someone greenlighting a $1 billion project to go and make this for 5 seasons because it feels great. But it's not how it's why TikTok has gone up. It's not because you're there to learn things. It's not like it's same with Instagram Reels. It's all of these things are moving to people just need to find a moment of escapism to feel connected, to feel comforted, rather than feel like I'm reading the Encyclopedia Britannica or truly learning something. So knowing this, Tubi felt like it had a real role to play where, yeah, there are moments where I want to explore things. I want to go deep on something. I want to feel I'm getting baked into a subculture or a genre that I'm really passionate about. But the majority of viewing is people having this on in the background while they've got another screen on. Like, you may have something on your smart TV that you may have already seen before, or something that takes you back to when you were a kid, or just some trashy reality TV while you're doing the dishes or while you're cooking dinner. Like, we are an ad-supported platform. We need people to watch as much as possible. And it doesn't have to be you watch one show and get out. Sometimes there's comfort in that warm blue glow of a TV screen, even if you're not watching it at all. So it felt like that's how the majority of viewing hours were spent, rather than where the majority of investment was, which are in those short 45-minute to one-hour moments a day with your partner watching something.
So, Nicole, you decide that you're going to go into, I mean, I don't know if it was a review or not, but you decide that you want to develop a new brand campaign. Tell us about what the ask you had of Mischief was, and what was the business challenge that you were, or the marketing challenge that you were sort of laying out in front of them?
So, Fergus, I had no time to RFP. I literally left Tinder, knew I was going to be taking a CMO role. Left Tinder in July, started this job in August, and I knew I had to put up a Super Bowl campaign. In addition to that, I also had to do a World Cup campaign because we were streaming World Cup in November as well. And so it's a short turn. And it's a short turn if you're inheriting a brand that does no brand book, no purpose, no emotional hook. And we had nothing starting at ground zero. So funny enough, Mischief was the partner agency at Tinder, and they actually got hired when I was out on maternity leave. So our time together at Tinder was super short, but I felt like by time I left, like, we just had a shared understanding, and I saw if given a good brief that they can really excel and really think differently about it. But before, when I was out, they were given some briefs that I felt like were like a little bit more performative. And so I was like, this agency got it. And I am always one of those people in partnerships that's like, the onus is always on both parties. You give a good brief, you should get a good response back. It's the client's job to do that. So we just had this moment before I left Tinder where like, they fucking crushed. And so in this new job where I am now, the CMO, I get to call the shots. Like, I can take as much risk as they'll let me. And so we sat down and we really thought about, okay, how do we make a Super Bowl campaign, but also figure out who this brand is at the same time? And I think within briefing, and I'll kick it to Ed to talk about how it is to receive it, the brief is super simple. And my objective for Super Bowl specifically was like, let's figure out, and a lot of it was like social listening and figuring out like, what are the truths of the Tubi experience and what do people love about it? And also, know that like all the only objective I need for that night is not understanding of my business, but for people to know my name, our name, Tubi, and not forget it. And because we had a huge awareness problem. So it really was just get attention. And I think it was that simple. And because I didn't know who the brand was, it wasn't like this meaty brief with all these RTB points that have to come across. So I don't know, Ed, why don't you talk about receiving the brief? Because like, and to be honest, like I didn't write it. Like one of the women that works for me, Cynthia Clevenger, wrote it, who had been at Tubi a bit longer. But I think we honed it and figured out how to make it very focused.
We'll be right back.
One of the things that makes this
the most effective advertising campaign in the world
so effective is the use of humor. Using humor to promote a professional development program like the Master of Advertising Effectiveness might seem unusual, but in fact, humorous advertising is among the most effective advertising. Yet the use of humor has declined considerably in recent years, which is the exact opposite of funny. To learn more about what makes advertising effective, head over to mae.academy. That's mae.academy.
Now back to the show.
Yeah, so I think when the brief fell on the desk and it was so good to be working with Nicole again, it was like my first question, I think, was everyone's, which was, what the fuck is Tubi? Like, we'd never heard of it before. It was, and that was really the heart of the problem. Like, if we as an agency who feel like we're pretty tapped into what's going on had no idea what the streaming service was, it was like, this is mad. Like, how do we do this? But it was really exciting because Nicole was really clear there were two things we needed to do. One, get people to know that Tubi exists. And number two, try and find out why Tubi exists, because that was the core to brand. Like, we were building the plane while we were flying. We were briefing and figuring this all out as we were trying to, like, how could we have that disruptive bang moment, but also how could we have a long-term brand platform that we could keep for years? Because the Super Bowl is, what, 113 million odd people there? You can't suddenly pivot your brand after that. So it was very much all or nothing on a really crunch timeline. But I think that clarity from the get-go of, hey, we don't know what we stand for, but we need to figure that out. But secondly, just do something that makes huge waves in the category, because we only have this moment once, was, yeah, super clear, but a huge ask in a very small amount of time.
So what was there a hypothesis, Nicole, that you guys might have put forward, or whomever wrote that brief, that this is what we think we are, or was it sort of just left open? Do you recall?
No, we obviously like talked about the cultural context of what's going on in the world right now, what's going on in streaming. There was this insight that people felt like they were having a very unique experience on Tubi. What they were watching were things that they love that they can't seem to find anywhere else. So we wanted to kind of talk about that experience. And that was one part of the brief. And the other part was just, you know, taking a beat from the tech companies of, you know, Reddit. And I think it was the year after Coinbase, of just like, we have this time, like, what can we do that's a hack that is similar to what those companies have done? Because it definitely, instead of coming off like an entertainment company, I think it's always been a part of the company's ethos to be like a little bit more tech and ad tech forward, and to behave in a completely different way than you would see an entertainment brand behave.
So Ed, what do you guys do from a planning perspective? You get the brief. Tell us about the highlights of what you guys did in planning.
Highlights. There were a lot of them, actually. So I think the first thing we did, as anyone would, was like, I think we had, what, 4 weeks to respond, 3 weeks, something like that. And I think the first thing we did is booked as many stakeholder interviews as possible, because we had this idea that Tubi was an access brand, and their tagline at that moment was free movies and TV. So it was very clear on what they do. They were free, they had lots of content, and more than we ever thought. And I think, like, some of the things that we found, there was a great, like, The Onion had an incredible article on Tubi, which was like, breaking news, Tubi CEO combs through Goodwill used DVDs looking for movies to upload. Like, it was really clear that it had, like, a huge amount of volume, but no perceived value in the marketplace. Like, but through more social listening and going slightly deeper, we found that there were certain subgroups that absolutely adored Tubi. Like, we didn't, because I think we were so conditioned to look at what was on Netflix or Max or all of these shows. But especially for like Detroit Black Cinema, for example, there was an enormous following and quite a few articles heroing Tubi as the space that is bringing the revival of that really underground Black cinema movement. Similar to horror and all these niche things, it felt like there were these pockets of people, these subgroups that really did love Tubi. We also had a look at the originals content because, I mean, as Nicole alluded to earlier, a lot of brands truly display who they are by the content they create. Like HBO / Max, it's always like quite thought-provoking. It's deep. It's grade AA plus content. Disney's obviously a bit more family-focused. Like, they have clear expressions of who they are by the content they create. I think for us, one of the biggest breakthroughs was we talked to their head of content, Adam, and he was like, he seemed like monoculture is just dead. I was like, why do you have all these shows? It just doesn't make sense. He said, monoculture is dead. It's no longer the time for people to make these giant shows that everyone watches. And that really sparked something in us. We dug a bit deeper into that and just like how people are engaging with film, or film and TV, where I think we can all probably hark back to the early 2000s or even the 90s and before, where film and TV and the language of film and TV were really baked into society, where you could quote a film, whether it was from like Anchorman or Austin Powers, anything like that, and everyone would instantly understand what it is that you're saying, and like they understand the reference, right? Where it feels like at the moment there is no real shared language. Like I can't assume that you've watched every episode of Game of Thrones or Stranger Things and will get a niche reference that I had. So it felt really true and authentic. And so as we went through that, we worked really closely with Nicole and team and came up with two potential ways in at that initial briefing stage. One was all around this idea of, like, I guess it was, how can we add value to the volume that exists within it? And it felt like one was this idea that quality of content is, we're being primed for it to be objective, where I see the awesome shows and I need to spend $500 million in order for a show to be perceived as good quality, to seeing the more subjective nature of it, where if a show is right for you, if you really like Shark Side of the Moon, that's great because there is an audience for it. If you like Freak Brothers, that's great because you might love smoking weed and this really resonates with you. That's quality content for you, even if it may not be for anyone else. So we had one which was around Find Your Weird, which was allowing people to go really deep, like incredibly deep into the things that made them unique and different and very much pushing on the fringe. And there was a second one, which was, I guess, was about like escapism, the idea that like we make your guilty pleasure not guilty anymore, that idea of it being like a liberating force. It's a chaotic world out there. Tubi's a bit of an escape from the real world. And I think in that first meeting, Nicole, we went through it and Nicole was just like, it's the first one. Like, it just has to be that first one. The other one, anyone could say, interesting, but like, this one's got teeth, this one's got edge. And I think within an hour, it was approved and we were straight into briefing from there, because it just felt like a really clear way for Tubi to turn their biggest weakness, which was perceived as having a shitload of content but nothing to watch. Like, it was all kind of B-grade for this mainstream audience that we were trying to break into, to actually our biggest strength, where because we have so much content and it is so offbeat, but because of that, you can go on this pathway, this rabbit hole, if you will, of content that feels like it's made almost exclusively for you. So you can lean further into what makes you different, as opposed to trying to be the same as everyone else within a monoculture.
So Nicole, you know, there's some people would say that they get a little bit freaked out, like, well, we're limiting ourselves by going down a path of Find Your Weird, but they're not realizing that probably everybody has their weird, right? So it really is sort of a niche proposition with mass appeal, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the idea. And also, like, Find Your Weird was the briefing. Find Your Weird was not what's said in a consumer-facing context to anybody. So, like, I mean, I think the brief that sparks great creative ideas I try not to get hung up on the language that's being used in that brief, because that's not the actual thing that comes to life. And I think that's an important nuance. And I don't think we showed weird. I don't think the work looks like that. I think the execution was a little disruptive and weird, because I think it's Super Bowl. And I think you kind of know what everyone else is going to be doing. And you're like, is anyone else going to have like this giant rabbit abducting people? And like, there's no VO, there's no dialogue. I wanted people to be like, what the fuck is this? And I knew that rabbit holes would be a fairly polarizing ad. And I thought, well, my biggest concern on that night is not being memorable. And if people are going to hate what they saw on screen, fine, they're talking about us. And if they love it, great. But I'm not going to try to make something that everyone's going to love. So it was the rabbit holes ad and execution was specific for, I think, the Super Bowl stage and the Super Bowl format. But Find Your Weird was the brief that gave us all these different creative ideas. And and the rabbit holes one was the first one. And immediately I was like kind of turned off and kind of uncomfortable. And in that moment was thinking like, maybe Mischief was a mistake. But well, after we went through like five creative ideas, it's the only one I couldn't get out of my head. Like, yeah. I couldn't stop thinking about how weird it was and arresting. And I then knew that if I had that feeling, and the others were fun and funny, but like, I feel like they almost would have blended in the landscape. I was like, that's the one for me, because it stayed with me, and I had this, it's the one that stuck, right?
But there was two spots you ran. You did the Super Bowl interruption and Rabbit Hole. Was that in the same Super Bowl?
That was in the same Super Bowl, yeah.
Yeah, we did Rabbit Hole first. So our idea was like, we're coming in, you see this strange ad, like Ed said, very different. And like, we literally have a rabbit abducting people. And then the next act in our playbook was to actually hijack and interrupt everybody's screens during Super Bowl.
So I thought I'd do a sidebar here just to explain what's happening, what you're going to be listening to. So the rabbit hole spot, you can go to our website and watch that. And since there's no audio, no voiceover, would be impossible to understand what's happening. But in essence, you've got rabbits, you've got people in big rabbit costumes. They are going around and in various places, dragging people out of their homes or out of their workplace or out of their cars, and then dragging them to a place where there's a large hole, a big rabbit hole, and dropping them into the rabbit hole. And as people fall into the rabbit hole, they're seeing this myriad of screens with shows of all different kinds that are lining the walls of the rabbit hole as they fall down into the rabbit hole. So obviously it's a metaphor. But I wanted more, and you can see that spot on our website, but I more importantly wanted to explain the interruption spot. So this is a spot that ran in Super Bowl, and it opens up as if you are cutting to the commentator's booth for the game, and you see the commentators, recognizable commentators for Fox Sports. And you think it's a natural just to cut away to the commentator's box. But then what happens is you get this feeling that somebody on the sofa has actually sat on the remote control, because it cuts away to the home screen of your smart television where you see all of the different channels. And the clicker looks like it's clicking around on the screen, and it ultimately selects a channel. It's actually Tubi. And it clicks into Tubi, and I can imagine people are just scrambling to figure out where the remote control is. But the remote control is clicking around within Tubi and ends up selecting a movie, and then you hear the Tubi sonic sound, whatever that's called again, and the spot ends. So it's only 15 seconds, but people are obviously freaked out in the same ways that in the middle, you know, late at night when I'm watching a show and I think my dog has stepped on the remote control, I'm doing the same thing, which is scrambling to get my remote control and get back to my show. But by the time you even get to that, you're back to the spot is finished. So it's only 15 seconds, but that's what you're going to be hearing here.
Welcome back to Super Bowl 57. So far, Greg, the game going like you expected?
Yeah, and so far, these teams, they've really...
So it seems that after that, because maybe it's just my own personal experience, but I feel like I'm seeing a lot more spots in rotation recently. And I'm wondering, is that true, or is it just the fact that you guys are on my radar and I'm just, you know, consciously subconsciously aware of it?
We just launched a campaign in September that says Just Keep Going. And it's, you know, kind of like the part two of rabbit holes of, you know, reminding people that they can find, you know, whatever it is they're looking for, whether it be, you know, rom-coms featuring sexy lifeguards.
So again, I just wanted to drop in here quickly for the listener just to say, if you haven't seen these spots, again, I'm going to drop the spots in, but I think that you can see them on our website. But if you don't get to the website, I want to explain this a little bit because they're so wonderful. So these spots, the second round of spots that have been running more recently, they're playing off the idea that you can go deep and that those shows that you're watching, you can just keep going and going and going and watch all of this content. And, so playing off of that, this new series of spots are playing up the idea of exaggerating this idea of things that keep going, things that keep happening, things that never end. So in the lifeguard spot, what you will be seeing is a lifeguard walking up to two women sitting poolside, and he pulls up his shirt to kind of reveal his abs. But as he continues to pull up his shirt, it goes up and up. His abs continue and continue and continue until roughly you begin to pull back and see that he's like 30 foot tall. So you've got a rack of 30 feet of his abs that have gone up. So it's dramatically exaggerated. Then in the second spot, which is my favorite spot, you're actually seeing sort of an old Miami Vice type clip from a show where you see these bad guys standing along the dock at midnight. You know, they're waiting for the drug drop or whatever. And you hear the speedboat slowly pulling up. And it just continues. You begin to see the front of the speedboat enter frame, but then it continues, and it's not only is it 20 foot long, it's 40 foot long, it's 60 foot long. It just keeps going before you ever get to see the guy who's sitting at the wheel of the boat. So it's just the same idea, exaggerating these dramatic moments, these interesting iconic moments. So enjoy.
Ooh la la, ooh la la, ooh la la, ah la, ooh la la, ooh la la, ooh la la, ah la, ooh la la.
On Tubi, the rom-coms where sexy heartthrobs lift up their shirts to reveal the most perfect abs you've ever seen. Just keep going.
Ooh la la, when I look in her eyes, when I look in her, looking at, ooh la la, when I look in her eyes.
Your man is late.
Look.
On Tubi, the crime dramas where global drug cartels use highly conspicuous speedboats. Just keep going.
The B2B side, I don't think we can underestimate how important that is for Tubi. Like, as an ad supporter, that's how it makes its money, like, full stop. And that's why we needed awareness at Super Bowl. It wasn't just for consumers. It was also to get more on the radar of media buyers. But what's interesting is, like, by doing that work at the Super Bowl within the category, as well as just within the minds of consumers, we were like the troublemakers. Like, we pranked 115 million people in one go and convinced them all that they'd change the channel on their remote. Like, we became the number four on trending on Twitter, just behind Rihanna and the two teams playing in the fourth quarter of a Super Bowl. Wild. But that same philosophy then was bled into the way that we talk to media buyers as well. So, like, we may have been dark to consumers, but the work that we did at the Super Bowl allowed us to talk to media buyers, our B2B audience, who's a very niche audience in their own right, in a really interesting and disruptive way. So instead of supporting upfronts, like a giant conference where all our competitors go and do a PowerPoint presentation for an hour and wine and dine. What would Tubi do? We created 3 5-minute long short films that were all around these like making media buyers the star of the show. So there's one around a media buyer trying to uncover what the Gen Z audience is all about. There's one who sent the wrong file, all with smaller directors, all talking to a small audience to prove to them that we had a unique audience.
How did you distribute those films?
It was actually quite funny. It was a classic Tubi all over again, where we knew where these media buyers were going to be, because they were all going to be at hotels around there. So
it was for new fronts. It wasn't up fronts. It was
on new fronts. Sorry.
Yeah, where the digital buyers are.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
So we had like a truck going around with the billboard. Like, we created a fake billboard as if it was an original launch that we did, and it was all on Tubi. So there were posters everywhere as if a new film was coming out. Like, Tubi's got everything for someone, even media buyers. We had trucks going around with digital billboards showing it, like, and on all of their platforms within a very small area, they were fed that constantly. So if we could treat media buyers as if they were a small segment and using their mediums, i.e. digital, as well as out of home and knowing where they were, it felt like, again, another really disruptive way to engage with a niche audience, which is the core philosophy of Tubi's brand from minute one.
Tubi is a brilliant example of getting to the simple truth of a brand and the simple proposition of the brand. And it reminds me of what it has always been my favorite ad ever produced, which ironically came from Greg Hahn, which was Herding Cats. Now, Herding Cats for me, which ironically was a Super Bowl spot for EDS and only ran once, just brilliant. It's today, I can still remember most every frame of it, but it's great to see that there are still clients who want to get back to the core of the simplicity of the brand in a way and present it in a way that's brilliantly compelling, memorable, and most importantly, attributable. If you're not getting attribution, you're not getting anything. And I think what you guys have done beautifully here is make sure that the brand is always associated with the idea. It is Nicole Parlapiano, Chief Marketing Officer, Tubi in Los Angeles, and Ed Gunn, EVP of Strategy at Mischief US in Brooklyn. Thank you both for your time. It was brilliant, and we really appreciate having you on.
Thank you.
Very good.
Awesome.
And we'll see everyone on the next episode.